I'm Liz Grossman.
I'm Rachel Gilman-Rischel.
And I'm Molly Each. You're listening to the Between Bites podcast, a nonprofit food-inspired storytelling series. We feature first-person stories from chefs, restaurateurs, writers, and others in the food and drink industry. Episodes are recorded live in Chicago bars and restaurants. We hope you enjoy.
Our next reader is the editor and publisher of the online Chicago food magazine, Fooditor, and a James Beard award-winning food writer and video maker based in Chicago. He has been a contributor to the Chicago Reader, Time Out Chicago, Where Chicago, Serious Eats, Thrillist, Air Canada's In-Flight Magazine, and others, and was also the editor of Grub Street Chicago. Please welcome Mike Gebert.
If you're a movie buff, tonight's theme, Spotlight and Shadows, suggests one thing, film noir. So here's my noir story, my pulp nonfiction, Wichita Confidential. The turquoise Plymouth Valiant sailed over the hump on West Douglas at Osage and came down hard, leaving Ralph Pierce bouncing on the springs like a hooker getting the feel of the bed. He glanced left, but the New Way Burger stand was dark. He tried to think what else might be open downtown at this time of night. Garvey's would have served its last slice of pineapple ham loaf for the evening. The Old Mill Tasty Shop would have kicked out the Bobby Soxers hours before. His best bet was the Fairland Cafe, a 24-hour diner and chop suey joint on East Douglas. He could hole up there as long as he liked. And there would be people, even a few cops probably, or reporters from the Eagle, somebody anyway, who would take some interest if a couple of guys from the Kansas City outfit showed up wanting to plug him. There were headlights in his rearview mirror. Had they been there all along? He ran the yellow light at Market, then chugged his transmission past the Eaton Hotel and the train station. The cafe was lit up like a dentist's office's fish tank. He T-boned the Valiant onto the side street west of the cafe, barely stopping to shut the car off before lifting his 350 pounds out of the seat, which seemed to give an audible sigh of relief. Pierce felt the seconds tick as he lurched up the concrete steps. The touch of his own sweat-soaked shirt on his back felt like the first tickle of a bullet. But he got to the top and pushed the glass door open, buffaloing his way past an old oaky contemplating the options in the cigarette machine. "Hello, Ralph," a dishwater blonde waitress said. "What's..." She didn't get any more out than that. Pierce collapsed into the booth at the far end of the room and perched himself against the back wall, facing forward. "Bring me coffee," he shouted. "Black, and keep it coming." Wichita, where I grew up, is the epitome of corporate chain dining now. Ersatz things like Longhorn Steakhouse and Carrabba's Italian Grill. But when I was a kid, there were still hints of an older, rougher place. A franchise operation of the Kansas City mob set up there to separate Okies from their wartime aircraft plant wages by selling all the usual vices. There were roadhouses where you could see Lefty Frizzell or Spade Cooley play and get knifed before the evening was over for your fun. Oil money, herds of Texas-style tycoons running around, meant there were higher-class joints, too, nightclubs with velvet walls and red lighting, where third-tier Vegas comics and showgirls on their last legs would appear. I'd get taken to such sophisticated places, the Lancers or the Candle Club or Lynx, by my parents, an adorable child. I would be plied with Roy Rogers mocktails by bemused bartenders. It all seemed glamorous to me. I love the attention. And you don't have to be Dr. Freud to figure my fascination with the fantasy worlds that people construct to sell food and drink goes back to having come in at the tail end of this showy era, with no idea what kind of a place it really was. The spotlight when we went out was on my grandfather, who had coached the local college football team for a decade, long before I was born, and was still one of those guys everybody in town liked to know. I'm sure I was a spotlight hog too, as little kids are, unselfconsciously, but soon enough, I was all too eager to hide in the shadows. My grandfather had a particular habit in restaurants, which was that he thought the best way to make a restaurateur's evening was to call him over the table and explain everything that was wrong with his steak. My grandfather could have been the cow coroner, minutely detailing postmortem insults to their flesh. This was an immensely cringy experience for me and my sisters. We'd sink in our chairs and under the table as the berating commenced. It was here that I developed the essential qualities of a food writer: silent observation skills, and the manner of an introvert who desperately wanted to stay out of the spotlight, where only embarrassing things, like my grandfather, happened. The trigger man from Kansas City hung up the payphone and returned to the car. "What did Nick say?" asked his partner. "He said to fucking sit in the car till the son of a bitch came out and plug him." They sat in the shadows in the parking lot, watching as people moved back and forth in the cafe as if it was a big TV set. "Christ, it's been 4 hours. How much coffee can you drink?" the driver said. "He's got to come out sometime," the other one said, though he was beginning to think, "Does he?" Inside, Ralph Pierce waved the waitress over. "More coffee, Gladys," he said. "Jesus, Ralph, you must have had 9 cups, she said. "Is everything all right? You sure you don't want something to eat?" "Do I look like I want to eat?" he asked. She looked at the red circles around his eyes and the way his fingers clutching a Winston trembled. "I guess not," she said, and started to turn away. "Hey, Gladys," he said, pulling a fat roll of bills from his pocket. "Is that car still in the lot?" "It's still there, Ralph. One of the fellers just used the payphone, but they're still there." He peeled off a 5 and handed it to her. "Keep the coffee coming." When I moved to Chicago, I instantly loved exploring the city, not just downtown or in Lincoln Park, but I'd sometimes venture to more exotic and dangerous neighborhoods like Lakeview. But at the same time, I felt something missing. Compared to how my father and grandfather had been known to the places we ate at in Wichita, I was a cipher, a drop in the bucket. My attorney wife and I would dine out with lawyers who were regulars at Frontera or Avanzare or Biche, but nobody knew me, a copywriter for ad agencies, where they hired them by the herd. In time, I discovered a site called Chowhound. The .com I'd worked for had boomed and busted, laying me off, and I suddenly had a lot of time to talk about tacos and chicken shawarma with strangers on the internet. That soon became dining out with strangers at these places we found. Chowhound, in its founder's original vision, was pure introverted writer. Pick up your food anonymously, race home to your computer, and talk about it online. But we made it into a modern cyber version of what my father and grandfather had done, which was to go into a restaurant and treat it as your own party, where you knew all the other people there. It was startling the first time that someone with a restaurant read and responded to something that we were talking about online. It was like another table overhearing our conversation and butting in. "What are you listening to us for?" "We're just guys yakking online." But we soon realized that we had a certain power to shine a spotlight on the places we really liked, and on ourselves. The sun rose on the Fairland Cafe as people streamed in to read the Wichita Eagle over a cup of coffee and some eggs. Lunchtime came, and then dinner. Waitresses went on and off shift, but two things never changed. Ralph Pierce sat holed up in a back booth inside, and 2 triggermen from Kansas City sat in a car in the lot, waiting. By the second day, Ralph, bloodshot and sweat-stained, was starting to get a bit ripe back there. It got to where the waitresses wouldn't come over to pour him coffee unless he peeled a 10 off his bankroll and waved it at them. The guys in the car were nearly as bad off. On the second day, they took turns running to their hotel to change clothes. That made the inside of the car more pleasant, but it didn't get them any closer to resolving the situation. They called Kansas City again and got the same answer. The son of a bitch has got to come out sometime, and when he does, plug him. The problem with being an introverted writer in the company of extroverts is that it's easy to not be there at all. At some point, I knew I was going to have to make my own spotlight. I started writing for The Reader and Time Out. I made videos of Sky Full of Bacon, videos in which you'll notice you hear my voice but very rarely see my face. In fact, I actually shot a kitchen demo once with me on camera, which you will never see. Still, I made myself comfortable enough with taking the spotlight that now I get up on stage at things like Between Bites. And as the designated obituary guy at the Jean Banchet Awards, and, well, the James Beard Awards. Even better, I got to know a lot of chefs and restaurant owners. So now I walk into a place and I greet the owner and I wave to the chef, much like my grandfather and father would have done. It feels like I've come into my family's legacy, into the spotlight of the Gerrards, restaurant kings. I just try to be a lot nicer about how I liked my steak. Wait, that's not the end. That can't be the end, you say. Enough about you. What happened with the standoff at the Fairland Cafe? Well, as I heard it, Ralph Pierce finally found a way out of there, probably caused by drinking coffee with almost no food for 2 days straight. He had a heart attack back in that back booth, and he was carried out of there on a gurney past the two guys from Kansas City and into an ambulance. They just had to sit there and watch it drive away, sirens blaring. I don't know what happened after that. I mean, all that stuff was way before I was born. And only a little bit of that world was left when my parents would take me to places like Link's, an old speakeasy on Highway 54. And I'd be served a Roy Rogers 7-Up with a splash of maraschino cherry juice. And an adorable child, all hopped up on sugary soda pop, I'd dance a wild, carefree little kid dance in the bar area to the delight of the boozy patrons and of the guy who ran the place, a longtime Wichita nightclub owner and reputed mobster named Ralph Pierce.
After working with chefs like Jean-Georges Von Richten, our final reader opened her first restaurant, Scylla, in 2004. In 2008, she made history as the first woman to win Bravo TV's Top Chef in season 4. In 2010, she opened Girl and the Goat, which garnered her Beard nominations for Best New Restaurant and Best Chef in America in 2011, and Best Chef's Great Lakes in 2012. In 2013, she won the Beard for Best Chef Great Lakes, and soon after that, opened Little Goat Diner, and then later Duck Duck Goat. She's a current contender on another show, the Food Network's Iron Chef Gauntlet, which airs on Sunday nights. So please welcome Stephanie Izzard.
I think the months leading up to the opening of Duck Duck Goat are a bit of a blur, as tends to happen when you try to look back at a restaurant opening. When I think back to opening Girl and the Goat almost 7 years ago, I have to really put in some effort to remember the details. Then when I do, I'm reminded that though I have convinced myself since then that the opening was smooth sailing, it was far from. It sucked. And it was amazing all at the same time. I do remember one particularly rough day very clearly. It must have been a couple weeks after opening. I had never worked in a restaurant, much less been in charge of one that sat so many people and served so much food every night. I remember placing produce orders for my first restaurant, Scylla, often outside of the bar Lemmings on Damon at 1 a.m. when it occurred to me that I had not called my orders in. I would order 5 pounds of onions or a crazy 10 pounds of potatoes at a time. At Girl and the Goat, we get in 75 pounds of green beans every day. Not something I was prepared for, and not a kitchen I really knew how to run. On the particular day I remember, I was trying to train 2 new prep cooks, both of whom seemed very fast and very skilled, but both who did not speak more than a word or two of English. While trying to train them, I was also working on my 3 goat specials of the day. For some reason, when we opened, I was convinced that the goat section of the menu should have 3 new specials daily. So I was running around figuring that out, which, as the procrastinator that I am, I mentioned I wrote this story this morning, I never really had a plan in place. I was working to show the girls how we smoked tomatoes for our smoked tomato aioli. We didn't have an actual smoker until after we almost burnt the restaurant down while trying to smoke goat legs on the grill with this sort of janky smoker that my butcher made. But that's a whole other story that Kevin probably wouldn't want me to tell you. So we just did it in a hotel pan on top of the stove. First step was we put some wood chips into a pan, cover it with water, and let it simmer for a few minutes to hydrate before we started our smoker. So we put the wood chips on, got our little tabletop smoker ready to go, and then we went down to cut the tomatoes in half and scoop out the innards. I'm not quite sure what of the many possible things distracted me, but it was a good 45 minutes before I remembered that I was supposed to be training how to smoke tomatoes. By the time I got upstairs, there was a hole burned clear through the bottom of the aluminum pan. I didn't even know that could I didn't even know that could happen. I'm looking at Carrie like, have you ever seen this happen? Like, in your, you know, 20 years of cooking, there's just all the way through the bottom of the pan. The rest of the day continued in that way, and I took the pan and hung it up in the middle of the prep kitchen to remind me of what I referred to as the worst day ever. That was that way when I thought I was having a rough one, I could look up and be reminded of how much worse it could be, and that I would get through it eventually. As for a little goat opening, I'm not sure I even want to dig up those memories. I was flipping pancakes for the first 3 months, opening the line at 5:30 a.m. and staying until the dinner rush started to die down. It was a tricky one. I know there was one Saturday when I had 5 or 6 orders of pancakes on my screen. Remind me not to open a restaurant with screens for tickets. I took this very slow elevator that goes up to the walk-in that we have upstairs. We had our pancake batter. And instead of taking the time to scoop out 4 quarts of pancake batter to bring down, I grabbed this 15-gallon Lexan of pancake batter, shoved it in the elevator, and ran it down the line like I was pushing one of those football training sleds at the gym. I don't know what those are called. I called it a football training sled. That's when the cooks knew that I had lost it. It's hard to describe the roller coaster of emotions that goes along with a restaurant opening. Your body's full of adrenaline, which helps you get through the 18 hours a day, 7 days a week schedule that starts months before opening and hopefully only lasts a few months after the doors open. One moment you're filled with excitement as you tape outlines on the floor of where the bar and the hotline are gonna be. A minute later, you have a meltdown, realizing that the walk-in cooler that looks so large on paper is in reality hardly enough to fit you in it. The space transforms before your eyes. Seeing the wall treatments come to life and the beautiful bar top before a single drink has even touched it feels magical. Heck, even watching the toilets being installed feels magical. Until you find out that the handles for the sinks next to the toilets are in back order, and the chairs that you ordered no longer come in the finish that you wanted, and the flatware you chose is 3 times as expensive as you thought, and the plumbing behind the bar was done wrong so water just goes all over the floor. Then you have the excitement of telling the servers who have been training for 5 weeks already that the opening has been pushed back another few weeks. Carrie's like, I know what you're talking about. Every day that the opening pushes back, you risk losing one of the cooks that you had lined up to another one of the city's many amazing restaurants opening every week. It's magic if you can even find enough cooks for an opening, much less hold on to them for weeks until you can start to actually pay them. Oh, the joys. But there's something about the thrill of opening that keeps chefs and restaurateurs coming back for more. After Little Goat, I promised myself I would never open another restaurant. 2 years later, I was sitting at a table with my partners Rob and Kevin discussing the ideas of a Chinese restaurant. For me, what made the opening of Duck Duck Goat something that is a bit of a blur, but also something I will never forget, is Ernie, our now almost 1-year-old boy, who was born just 2 months after the opening. I mean, it was restaurant number 3. Supposedly, things would get much easier the third time around, so it seemed only fitting to up the ante a little bit and try to get a restaurant open while being quite pregnant. I was 39 and thought it was about time to focus on starting our family. I went to the doctor to get the lowdown, since I was older and figuring getting pregnant was going to be a challenge. I figured by the time we got the restaurant open, I might be pregnant. Whoops. She gave really good advice, and I guess I was pregnant a month later. With the opening about six months out, so it seemed like it would work, or so I thought. Fortunately, we had gotten our team research and development trips to China and Taiwan in before I was with baby. We had spent a month or so total traveling through 5 cities on mainland China and through most of the island of Taiwan, which was amazing, eating as much as any person can consume in a day, as we learned how much we did not know about Chinese cuisine while we were trying to immerse ourselves into the culture for inspiration. After growing up eating Chinese food probably weekly and continuing into my adulthood relying on Chinese food to feed me when I had no desire to cook or when I needed to nurse a hangover, I thought I knew Chinese food decently well. I was wrong. There were and still are so many techniques and flavors that I had not experienced in my years of eating Americanized Chinese food. We had a lot to figure out. What was the menu going to be? Americanized, like the food we thought we loved before our travels? Authentic? Or as authentic as a not Chinese chef could achieve? What would our guests be looking for and what would they enjoy? Who knew? I remember in one interview about the opening, I was having a writer ask me, who's your Chinese chef gonna be? I was like, me? We started researching and testing after each of our trips overseas, going through photos of the hundreds of dishes we had, trying to recall what flavors we had and tasted and trying to crack the ancient Chinese secrets. Thanks to YouTube and the ability to watch something over and over again, I was able to figure out how to make many different dumpling varieties. I still remember very clearly the day I made my first hargao. I had taken many different recipes I'd found online and gotten a pretty clear understanding of what the dough was supposed to feel like. And for the folding, I had to watch countless videos of women making dumplings faster than I could imagine ever being able to do. Finally, I'd found a video that showed the special hargao fold close up and slow enough in detail, demystifying the process of getting the little dumpling to have the perfect little folds and curve just like a crescent moon. I gave it a try, and it worked. And then I steamed it, and it worked. I then put the tiny dumpling in my hand, and I ran full speed across to Girl and the Goat to show my sous chefs what I had done. I was so proud. I kept it for a while, and then it kind of just, you know, it started to shrink up like a shrinky ding. One tiny little perfectly folded dumpling, one, and it took a few minutes. Next step would be figuring out how to make hundreds of them a day, how to hold the best, and how to make a number of different doughs to have a whole dim sum menu. The rest of the menu was also in the works, taking flavor profiles we recalled from our journeys, as well as dishes we had read about or heard about, and trying to turn them into a balanced menu. Tricky bit was that my chef de cuisine, Jan, has a much higher tolerance for spice than I do. Trickier was that a few months into the menu development, also a few months into Ernie and my tummy, I developed an inability to eat anything Sichuan. Even the smell that I once loved so much became a huge turnoff for me. I'm happy that we created some of our go-to Sichuan sauces and dishes before this kicked in, otherwise they may never have made it onto the menu. At that point, I needed my husband to help me get my compression socks on and off, and I needed my sous chefs to help me taste the food. I remember the day that my partners, Rob and Kevin, came over for the first taste of Duck Duck Goat. I was so excited and proud of all the progress we had made, all of the dishes that seemed so close to ready, all of the bold Chinese flavors we had felt we now understood. I was coming from one of my many doctor's appointments, running late and rushing to get things prepped with Jan, my chef de cuisine, and Dan, our sous chef, at my house. We had close to a dozen dishes to showcase, all of which we thought were getting darn near tasty, or so we thought. It was an eye-opening disaster. The northern-influenced cumin goat was not something that I think Rob or Kevin would ever eat on purpose again. The twice-cooked pork was closer to steamed, as we learned that cooking in a wok on a home stove is not the same as a jet engine wok burner. The mapo tofu was an overly sloppy, gloppy mess. I can now hardly remember all that we cooked that day, but I remember feeling defeated. Running home from the doctor so excited and anxious to show off what Chinese secrets we had cracked, then realizing that we were a couple months from opening and not even close to having a menu. I'm sure my hormones were part of the reason that I suffered a mini breakdown after this tasting day. I've never been one to ask for others' opinions of my food, really, which some might think is because I'm just that confident in it, but honestly, it's quite the opposite. I'm usually too nervous or embarrassed to ask others for their opinions, for fears that the food is just terrible. Even just last week, we put a new Japanese-inspired grouper dish on the menu. I brought it to my servers to taste, explained it to them, then walked away. I went to my manager afterwards and said, "What did they think?" I don't think they liked it. Asking if they had hated it. I told my chef de cuisine, Aaron, to ask around for me and see what the servers thought. This happens every time I put a new dish on a Girl and the Goat. I guess if I were a painter, I would not want to stand in the gallery and listen to everyone's comments on my work. Food, like art, is just so personal that it's hard to hear critique, I guess. I'm sure my raging hormones did not help matters much at the time of my tasting with Rob and Kevin. So after the first tasting at my house, I sent emails to Rob and Kevin apologizing for letting them down. This was, after working together for 6 years, the first time we'd ever done a tasting. They just usually trust me. And so I think I felt even worse about it. And we've not done one ever since. Kevin has always been very supportive and motivational. His response was, and I looked through some old emails, "You're the most naturally gifted chef I know, and I just don't want to see your natural improvisational skills be handcuffed in certain dishes in the name of being traditional." And so, after some little disputes between Jan and I over the level of authenticity our food would uphold, we wound up with a reasonably authentic Chinese menu. Some things such as mapo tofu should just not be tinkered with, so that stays quite true to what you would find in China. Some things you would never find in China because they were invented for the American palate, such as crab rangoon, we also serve proudly since fried cream cheese just makes me happy. 2 months after opening, we launched dim sum on the weekends, and there I stood 3 days from my scheduled C-section, expediting. I turned around, and there was a doctor from the women's practice where I went to the doctor enjoying dumplings at the bar. "What the heck are you doing, Stephanie? You should be resting." "Well, the food's not going to send itself out. Plus, it's better than a few weeks ago when you should have seen me actually trying to work the walk station. Now that was just plain awkward." The opening was a bit of a blur, as I said. Lots of ups and downs, lots of struggles, as there always is. Like realizing that every dough we had thought we mastered worked completely differently in the new space and we had to rework all the recipes. Or finding that the Peking ducks that we thought we had mastered after nearly a year of testing did not work the same when we tried to put 20 of them in a tiny cooler. It all worked out, and then came Ernie. And though there were the usual opening pains, I realized that opening a restaurant when you're 7 months pregnant might actually be the smartest way to do it. I was too stressed about the restaurant to even think about how uncomfortable I was, and I knew I only had 2 months to micromanage, so it forced me to be a bit more organized with my sous chef team. I've never been good at ending stories. I'm not quite sure what the takeaway here is, especially since my specialty seems to be going off on tangents rather than sticking to the underlying theme. In the spotlight, I get a lot of, wow, how do you do it all? And in the shadows, I'm just trying to find my car keys and make sure I've remembered to pack some diapers.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about us at between-bites.com and follow us on social media as Between Bites.